I'm Bob Davidson, head of international arbitration at JAMS. Many people ask about becoming an international arbitrator. In this 8-part podcast series, I will present to you the very basic aspects of creating and maintaining an international arbitration practice. In this, the first of the series, I want to describe to you, first, the history of international arbitration. Second, the various differences between international and domestic arbitration, in particular, the vocabulary and legal background. And lastly, the various institutions of which you need to be aware if you wish to pursue a career in international arbitration. And first, the history. In 1925, to reverse a long-standing judicial antipathy toward private methods of adjudication, Congress passed the FAA, the Federal Arbitration Act, a subject with its own significant history and one we won't spend time on here. In 1970, the so-called New York Convention was created under the auspices of UNCTRAL, which is an acronym that stands for the United Nations Commission on International Trade Law. The New York Convention, which is properly called the Convention on the Recognition and Enforcement of Foreign Arbitral Awards, requires that signatories to the convention honor written arbitration agreements and enforce arbitral awards made in another signatory country, no matter whether the arbitration was the product of a pre-dispute or post-dispute arbitration agreement. The New York Convention, which is a multilateral treaty now signed by about 140 nations, places arbitration on a superior footing to domestic judgments because they are enforceable. These awards in any signatory country, while national or foreign court judgments are not automatically enforced. Since the New York Convention, many arbitration service providers and organizations have created rules and procedures, but we'll wait a few minutes to get into those. What are the differences between domestic and international arbitration? The major differences between domestic and international arbitration are first vocabulary, and second, the differences in process that arise from differences between the civil and common law legal systems. First, the vocabulary. Any domestic arbitrator has to learn that in arbitration we don't have plaintiffs or defendants. Rather, we have claimants and respondents. We don't have judgments or verdicts. We have awards in arbitration. There are more, but this podcast isn't intended to highlight those differences. Instead, I'll focus on the different vocabularies used in domestic U.S. arbitration and those used internationally. There aren't many, but if you want to have a career in international arbitration, you need to be clear on the vocabulary. In the U.S., we confirm or vacate arbitration awards. Internationally, we, in the language of the New York Convention, quote, recognize and enforce, unquote, rather than confirm, or, quote, refuse recognition and enforcement, unquote, rather than vacate arbitral awards. In the United States, we talk about discovery. Internationally, we speak of, quote, disclosure, unquote, which is supposed to connote a much narrower view of discovery. That's the sum of the major vocabulary differences, and now let's look at the major distinction. The civil versus the common law. As you all know, we live and work in a common law legal system, and most of the world lives in the civil law legal system. What are the differences? In the common law, the development of the law is not only embodied in statutes or codes, but is also developed through judicial decisions that often have binding effect on a lower court, the concept of stare decisis. The process is lawyer-driven, with the judge acting like a referee. The process culminates in a single, clear terminal event called a trial. In civil law jurisdictions, the judge is an inquisitor, and the lawyers are merely sources of information. It's a didactic process. The judge decides what he or she wants or needs to know. It's mostly done on paper, and it can go on for whatever period of time the judge wants. And eventually the matter will terminate in some sort of written decision. Testimony might be taken, but that's not always the case. It's useful to know that when you're working in international arbitration, most of the lawyers will be used to the civil system, at least if they're lawyers that come from jurisdictions outside of the United States or England or Canada, as the common law is by far the lesser used of the two. Most importantly, you should understand that the one place where the civil and common law systems clash is in international arbitration, where you will have to balance the needs, training, and expectations of the parties from both systems of law. What are the sources of law and authority in these systems? Some treaties and laws with which you should be familiar are what I mentioned before, certainly the New York Convention, which is codified in Chapter 2 of Title 9 of the U.S. Code, that's Chapter 2 of the Federal Arbitration Act. We have the Panama Treaty, which is codified in Chapter 3 of the FAA. That basically applies the New York Convention to Latin America. Sources of law also include national and local laws varying from case to case depending on the parties and the stipulations in the arbitration agreement. And lastly, the arbitration agreement itself and the provider rules that are referenced in that agreement. Let me spend a little time on this last pair. What does an international arbitration agreement contain? Well, similar to domestic arbitration clauses, it contains most usually a choice of a place of arbitration, where at least presumptively to conduct the hearings, where a losing party must move to deny recognition and enforcement. That's going to be where the place of arbitration is designated, that is, where to vacate an adverse award. The place of arbitration is also the law which will govern the procedural aspects of the arbitration, such as the availability of interim relief in aid of arbitration. Usually, the arbitration agreement will usually specify the language to be used. It's usually English, which is a break. If no language is nominated, the tribunal is supposed to choose one and be prepared for a big headache as you cope with multiple languages, often in live hearings, translated documents, and the award probably has to be written in multiple languages. There's a choice of law, which is often in a standalone or additional clause in the agreement. And if you aren't familiar with the chosen law, don't panic. You can require them to prove the law in the course of the proceeding. An arbitration agreement internationally will often have the required qualifications of the arbitrator, similar to what we see domestically, but with a slight international spin. It will also have the choice of the provider and the provider's rules. And the choice of the provider will determine those rules, will determine much of the arbitral procedure. Now, who are some of the main providers in international arbitration? Well, we have JAMS, JAMS International. We do have our own international rules, and we'll cover the most important of them in future podcasts. There's the ICC. Now, the ICC is based in Paris. It stands for the International Chamber of Commerce. They have facilities in Paris, although most of their proceedings occur anyplace in the world, not necessarily in Paris. The ICC is a very interesting institution. It's been around for a very long time. And many of the international cases, especially the very large ones, will have ICC clauses contained in the contracts. There's the ICDR, the International Center for Dispute Resolution. That's the international arm of the American Arbitration Association. They do a significant amount, administer a significant amount of international arbitrations. There are major international or regional providers. They include the LCIA, the London Court of International Arbitration in London. We have the Hong Kong International Arbitration Center. We have CTAC, the China International Economic Trade and Arbitration Commission, acronym is CTAC. They're the official state arbitration agency in China. We have the Singapore International Arbitration Commission, or SIAC, S-I-A-C. We have ICSID. ICSID is very interesting. International Center for the Settlement of Investment Disputes. It's the settlement or arbitration arm of the World Bank. They're headquartered in Washington, but the proceedings can occur anywhere. The proceedings involve at least one sovereign state, and they arise out of a sovereign state's adherence to a multilateral convention. Either a bilateral investment treaty or a multilateral investment treaty. that compels a foreign state to arbitrate disputes that investors might bring, that they're being treated unfairly or the property was expropriated or taxed away in some unfair fashion. There are hundreds of bits, I think the last count might be 1,000 bits, all over the world. And there are a lot of these proceedings. They're very prestigious to sit in. They don't pay a lot. They usually are, in the $500 an hour range or so. But definitely do one if you have the chance. It's a very interesting experience, and you are prone to sit with very prominent international arbitrators. Now, last but definitely not least, with respect to the rules of these institutions, is UNCTAD. I mentioned before the United Nations Commission on International Trade Law promulgated rules and promulgated a model law. Now, the UNCTAD model law and the UNCTAD model rules are really the dominant statute and rules which will be used in international proceedings. They were first used really extensively in the U.S.-Iran Claims Tribunal in the 1980s. Now, in the hope of not dominating too much of your time, we'll stop now and let you digest what we've covered so far.